is time for David Tarachuk to join us. It is time for the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning, and we take a look at the media, the coverage that they're doing, what they're covering, and how they're covering it. And, of course, you can find David at his own website, themediabeat.us. David is also a PBS television correspondent reporting on ethics and belief, and we're always pleased to have him join us here on Robin Hood Radio. Good morning, David. David, you there? Hello, David. Well, that's not good. We'll try this again. Why not? We can do this again. It'll be the first time. Doesn't seem like it. I'm going to do this right here. See if we can reach him. There we go.
Yeah, I lose you.
David, we have a very weak connection there. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
How are you this morning?
Are we on the air?
We are on the air.
Well, I'm glad to be joining the keen-eyed Marshall Miles again, coming to you once more as regularly for now from the media capital of the world, New York City. And Marshall, coming from New York, I cannot fail to report this piece of science news that appeared overnight in a well-documented report in no less an authoritative outlet than the New Statesman magazine. How about this? I'll read you the headline. Dolphins spotted swimming in the Bronx River. Major news for us. That river, you'll know, Marshall, was once an industrial waste dump site.
And yes.
Now the very rarely excitable, very serious magazine, The New Scientist, says, this is great news. It shows that the decades-long effort to restore the river as a healthy habitat is working. So, makes you proud to be a New Yorker.
Either that or there's some super strain of dolphins.
Powerful immunity developing against the Bronx industrial contaminants. Yeah, that could be happening. But the obvious mainstream headlines of the week are in a way hardly worth talking about, since there's so little to actually say. There's more fuss, of course, this week because more documents have been found, some of them classified, from Joe Biden's previous gig as vice president. They ended up somewhere they shouldn't, in his home garage, as well as a previous out-of-government office closet. It's all embarrassing, for sure, and the White House press team is doing what press teams are generally not well advised to do in embarrassing times. They're clamming up. We have nothing to say, they say, repeatedly. Biden's spokesperson is now referring questioners to the White House counsel's office, who also says very little, and to the special counsel investigating the matter at the Attorney General's behest. And he, Prosecutor Robert Hur, on the job now, is of course saying exactly nothing, too. And the other mainline story this week, about which is really little to be said, is the apoplectic deadline-itis, if I can call it that, about the national debt ceiling. Every few years, as you know, this story rolls around, and after huffing and puffing, usually a new arrangement gets to be made to raise the ceiling again. Those refusing until the last minute to agree to the rise have, in modern times anyway, mainly been the anti-public spending Republicans. So it wasn't always that way. And the last time it got really overheated in President Obama's time, that infamous, you remember it, the kerfuffle about it all was enough to get that shadowy court of judgment, the International Credit Rating Agency, Standard & Poor's, to downgrade America's credit standing internationally. Talk about embarrassment. the United States of America demoted from AAA to AA+. But currently, in the current kerfuffle, it's a standoff, more huffing and puffing, and the Treasury is doing the predictable shuffling of funds. The term of art every time this comes around is, of course, extraordinary measures. You can almost hear the capital letters, right? To keep the public purse performing its usual function of doling out funds for government departments to function. And in almost a ceremonial way, we can be prepared for things like federal parks to be closed at some point. It's almost a rite of passage every time. It's a somewhat more interesting standoff this time, if you can get interested in these things, since the only person this time at the negotiating table is the Republican leader, the new Speaker of the House, Kevin McCarthy. No one else is showing up to talk with him, nobody from the White House or the Treasury or from elsewhere in Congress. So he's in a kind of lonely position there.
Well, and what makes...
I want to do a call in, you know, as we rarely do these days, I'm afraid, Marshall, our fanfare. Let me talk about another White House event this week that got reported on, but not with a lot of headline attention, certainly not as much as it deserved. That was the visit to the White House and President Biden's hosting of the Dutch Prime Minister, Mark Rutte. It wasn't at the top of the news agenda for the mainstream media outlets, and when they did cover it, there was a lot more emphasis, understandably perhaps, on the Dutch decision to increase their aid for Ukraine in fighting back against invading Russians.
Let's bring the fanfare. We'll bring the fanfare in.
Well, I'll get to the fanfare in a moment.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you're so desperate to use the fanfare. We haven't used it for a long time. Let me use the fanfare because this.
Go on.
Go on. No, you go on. Let's hear that fanfare.
Okay. All right.
Oh, gosh. We are so out of practice, aren't we?
Yes.
Well, the fanfare is for a story that didn't get reported so much in the mainstream until you look to the international news wires about that Dutch visit. It's actually for the Register. I want to fanfare the Register. It's a British news site founded in the 1990s and devoted to tech matters. Technological journalism, it's a vital part of our landscape now. Since the 1990s, it's now claiming an audience of about 40 million people worldwide, mainly of technology professionals, and maintaining a hefty emphasis on tech security. Quite separate from the Ukraine issue during the Dutch visit, there was the effort by Joe Biden to get Holland to stop providing China with computer chips. That's why it's a technology story. I mean, it's probably not generally understood that in the U.S. It's not really understood quite what an absolutely vital cog Holland is in the global industry of producing semiconductors. The Register gave us this week a thoroughgoing explanation of all the issues involved, because the Dutch company, ASML as it's known, makes a very specialized, I'll use the exact term for it here, extreme ultraviolet lithography. It's a glorified, very glorified printer, in essence, and it's essential for making the most sophisticated computer chips. And without them, China can't make the chips at all. And that's what the Biden administration, like the Trump administration before it, wants to achieve. The Register reported that the Dutch government will now, they got this on good authority, will fall in behind U.S. policy entirely. So now, I guess the next job we need to watch Washington get itself into in a serious way is to ensure that nobody else, no other country, steps in to fill the void for supplying China. I think we need to look out for Canada, Mexico, Japan, who are bound to be leaned on very heavily, too, by the United States.
You know,
That's one big important international story that we have to look into some fairly detailed outlet sources to get the full coverage.
Well, when you look at that story, you go back in time. Most people don't realize that Japan's attack on the United States in World War II was basically how we were strangling the Japanese about iron. It was a financial that was the final that broke the camel that broke the camel's back. And it turns out that way, where if you can push a country far enough to the brink, where they're really their economy is in shambles and is not really part of the world economy, serious things can happen.
Yeah, it's a risky process. At the moment, the big news out of China, of course, is the fact that they're not growing as fast as they were, not growing in terms of population, which is a remarkable thing in itself. We always think of China as a rapidly expanding slice of humanity. But also their economy is slowed by the whole COVID experience. And, a big, important country that's in trouble economically is a risky opponent to have because the more desperate they get, the less predictable comes their reaction to any efforts that we might make in the West to cajole them. But on another international development, which is both very broad in its impact, there's certainly been a lot of reaction to it, but also very personal in its center, is the announcement by Jacinda Ardern that she's, it's quite a sudden announcement, that she's unexpected, stepping down after just one term as her country's leader, New Zealand, of course. What I saw an opinion writer in The Guardian describe as her graceful departure as the leader of New Zealand, the Prime Minister, is having quite an impact. I mean, she puts me in mind of a remarkable leader I got to know in a distant war in Africa a long time ago now, Joachim Chissano. He was the general, the military general, commanding the Liberation Army that was fighting against the Portuguese colonial power in the 1970s in the country of Mozambique. After Mozambique won its liberation and Portugal withdrew, Chissano, who I found to be a remarkable authoritative, very humane individual, he became president and was a president of the new country for two terms. The country's independence constitution gave him the right to a third term, but he decided it was time he stepped down. Just like Jacinda Ardern, and in this, he was actually he was prefiguring his good friend from South Africa next door, who Nelson Mandela, who became the first black president of a suddenly democratic South Africa, and he left office after only one term, even though their constitution allowed him a second one. Which, of course, he would, if he'd run for it, he would overwhelmingly have won. And back in Chisano, in Chisano's Mozambique, it was Chisano himself who helped to change Mozambique from a one-party Marxist state that it started out being, and turned it into a multi-party democracy. So, you know, the capacity for a leader to step away from the greasy pole, as it's called, is a striking thing. And Prime Minister Ardern herself said in her announcement to the press, very, very honestly and rather typically of her, I'd say, that she had, what was the quote, nothing left in the tank to do the job for another 5 years. That's a very interesting development, and I'll just underline again the Guardian's term for it, a graceful departure. I think we've got to wonder what our 80-year-old president here in the States has got to say about it. So far, I don't know if you have seen anything, but I've seen no comment from him or from his staff about Jacinda.
No, and you know, that's a problem in this country that is happening in local politics. There's so much at stake now, and there's so much lawyering up. It's not like it used to be. People just aren't running because of the pressures of the job, and I think that translates into what she had to put up with. I mean, obviously, there's only so much a person can put up with, and that's a bad sign when somebody as bright and as energetic and as young as that, the pressures and demands of the office just crumbled her down. That's not a great sign.
No, it's not. And on the other hand, there's a kind of opposite tendency at work too, which is that people get get to employ the advantages of incumbency. So right across America now, you will notice something of a gerontocracy. Lots of old people in office for a long time. I've got no room to talk. I cling to my professional, activity desperately. You know, you pull it from my cold, dead hand. The idea of stepping aside and letting the next generation take over is a valuable principle as well as that of contributing your wisdom and experience as you get older.
But you have to have the next generation willing to take over.
Well, that's true. It's not very appealing, to be in the public eye anymore. It's not as appealing as it might well have been for a lot of people once upon a time.
It's a tough call. Well, anyway, when we look what's going on in the world, I mean, you look at China, and they're having massive problems with their economy simply because they've just thrown up their hands, and there's no way they can control COVID in their country, and so by opening up and loosening the reins, they're hoping that economy gets back on track. But you look at that there, you look that the Wagner Group is recruiting for Russia and Serbia. You look at the Ukraine needs tanks from Germany and the United States. I mean, we can go on and on and on and on about how wildly this world is acting right now. It's something that I don't think the world has seen ever. Maybe it's because we're so media hit over the head with media. We all know what's going on, or we think we know what's going on. But I haven't seen an area like this where there's so much disruption in the world as there is right now.
Yeah, it's hard to tell whether, I mean, it would take a very considered historical review to see if we are actually in a more chaotic condition internationally now than we have been before. I suspect there have been times when it was every bit as serious. And certainly, of course, in the last century, we had two world wars, wars that were fought. Not just in one continent, but in multiple regions of the world, and that happened twice over within two generations. The 20th century must go down as one of the periods of greatest upheaval in our history overall. But as you say, we seem to be in a situation where there are the makings of massive upheaval right across the globe, and it's a very moot question. At least it's a very intriguing question whether it genuinely is that way, or it's just because it's not a matter of just or merely. It's a matter of fact that we are getting much more information about what is going on around the world than we ever used to get. The information overload, the fire hose of news that comes at us, is so con- you know, extraordinary, different from anything we had, oh, only 25 years ago, I suppose. The acceleration and the increase in volume of information coming our way as news consumers now has developed so fast in just the last 25, 30 years that it's tempting to say that we know too much about the world. Now that flies in the face of, you know, my main principle is that we need as informed citizens to get as much information as we can. But on the other hand, you know, how much is enough? It's a very difficult, almost philosophical concept to get our heads around.
And how much of that social media news is actually accurate? That's the other thing, that there is no control over that. You know, when you had major newspapers all over the world, and you had true reporters, and there was someone to answer to. There is no one to answer to with social media. Everybody's their own editor.
Right, everybody's their own publisher too, and we can decide what we think we want to ventilate ourselves and take part in the process of passing information on. There's an awful lot of responsibility on the individual consumer now, and you know the responsibility is upon the professional reporters whose job it is to find this information and double check it before it is published. Those pressures are enormous now. There's a story that I did want to highlight that is an example of news being brought to us, even though it's in an environment in which it's very difficult to operate. And from Texas, here's one of those stories that it's always hard to get a complete and reliable handle on, not because it's Texas. Although you know Texas is sometimes a difficult place to report on, but conditions, especially inside a prison, inside Texas's prisons, they're never easy to report on. No state really makes it very easy to report on prisons with anything like a satisfactory degree of accuracy, as I know all too well from my time spent on the prison beat as a journalist. But the story of the moment is that scores of prisoners in Texas, over 70, maybe even as many as 130, 140, are now entering their second week of a hunger strike. And they're protesting the state's groups of solitary confinement, that particular form of lockup, something I've reported on repeatedly, as you know, Marshall. In Texas, it's probably in use more than any other state in the country. Texas currently has more than 3,000 inmates in what they call restrictive housing. It's one of a range of euphemisms that's used about this. Some states and some jurisdictions call it administrative segregation. Those 3,000 in Texas, more than 500 of them, have been in isolation for more than 10 years. Something like 130 have been in isolation for at least 20 years. I'm not trying to single out Texas here. It's just that the hunger strike is happening there, and it's being reported there, though with great difficulty. Advocates are our only way into what's going on with the prisoners who made this decision to attempt the protest. It's so widespread in Texas. But on the other hand, we can look nationwide and we'll see there are still, it's hard to believe this in a civilized society, there are 80,000 people in solitary confinement in America's prisons as a whole. In Texas, the issue at the moment for the prisoners that have prompted this hunger strike is that while it can sometimes be punishment for uncooperative behavior, in Texas it's become an almost automatic official response to prisoners being gang members or displaying some sign of being a member of a gang. And they're, you know, getting to report on this is hard because, as I say, we have to rely on outside advocates for information. But we need to keep watching the situation, I'd say. If you know, even though we can only do it obliquely and from afar, the campaign is modeled. It reminds me very much of the campaign in California back in 2013, when there was a hunger strike there, and it took 2 years, but the California inmates were successful in the end in litigating a federal settlement, which ended the use in that state. Certainly, the use of it based on alleged gang status, as is the case in Texas now. There's a story to watch, even though it's difficult to get the hard and fast kind of information that we would really want.
All right. Always great to talk to you, David. We'll see what happens in the next week, and I'll see how tough it is to get the budget deal and the limit raised with those 20 strong Republicans. I think we're in for quite a week ahead of us.
Well, quite a couple of years heading up on the congressional front, at least. I look forward to talking to you next week.
All right. Take care, David. David Tarachuk with the Media Beat. Of course, you can find David at his website, which is themediabeat.us, themediabeat.us.